Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's been weeks now since the uprising in Tunisia transformed the government of what they were used to calling Little Tunisia.
Yeah, they still call it Little
very
Tunisia.
Big, that's for sure. 15 days, of course, in protests in Egypt. We've talked a lot in both nations about the transitional period as this country prepares to embrace some form of governance that's very different from the autocratic regime that it's left behind. But is it going to be like the democracies that we understand in the West or elsewhere in the world? What are the choices for the individuals who will eventually be responsible for setting up the institutions of statecraft in Egypt and in Tunisia? Joining us is Akbar Ahmed, who's chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University. He's Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom and author of Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. He's on the line from Bethesda, Maryland. Professor, good morning.
Good morning, John.
So it's great to talk with you. And I'm wondering if there's a sense of excitement for you as a historian and as an expert in this field to imagine the choices facing whoever is going to get the opportunity to create the institutions of government, be they democratic, be they whatever, in, say, Egypt.
John, incredibly exciting moment in history, especially for someone like me, a Muslim with the Pakistani background, firmly believing in democracy, firmly believing in human rights, civil liberties, all the essential features of modern society, and knowing that that is compatible with Islam, which is such a central question, and knowing that probably for the first time in history, the Egyptian people themselves have risen, and risen remarkably. Note two features in this revolt of the Egyptians. Number one, the peaceful nature of the revolt. You saw the early days, women with children, old men, young men, a lot of young men tweeting and using all the modern technology. And secondly, the nature of the revolution itself, which was inclusive. So these are remarkable features for any revolution. You know, we've been studying revolutions in Iran and in China and in Russia. Revolutions are very bloody and very messy. So initially, the Egyptian revolution was really a pure delight to watch. It challenged all the notions of traditional revolution. It was
right.
Coming from Egypt. The first time the people of Egypt had spoken, the leaders.
As we move forward, Akbar Ahmed, what are the models? Are they contemporary models of one man, one vote democracy, one person, one vote democracy, or are they older models, maybe even 1,000 years old? When the Islamic Republic of Iran was established, they relied on models that were quite a bit older than the secular models of, say, Turkey or Pakistan.
You know, John, I've been involved in this debate for a long time. I've also been an administrator in the field. And you cannot compromise with democracy. Either you have it or you don't. For me, the simplest and purest form is the democracy envisaged by the founding fathers of this nation, this great nation. One man, one vote. And of course, at that time, you didn't have African Americans and women being allowed to vote. But they were included eventually. That is the ideal. So if you tamper around with the notion of democracy, you compromise it right from the start. And I would want, if it's possible at all, and I hope they get it in the end, one man, one vote, one woman, of course, included. And that's it. So no tampering. And secondly, accountability. Thirdly, limited terms of office. We don't want people to be ruling for 30 years. Go back to George Washington. He could have declared himself king. He could have said, I'll be president for life. No, he laid down the terms. So these rules of democracy have to be adopted. It's going to be very difficult. This is the first time it's happening. The Arab world has been divided into dictatorships, military dictatorships, or dynasties. They really haven't had anything like a pure democracy. They've had diluted, distorted, perverted democracies.
What?
Saddam Hussein's democracy or Mubarak's. So it is time now for a pure democracy to be introduced to the Arab world.
Where is that dividing line then, Akbar Ahmed of American University, between, say, a democratic state that maybe recognizes Islam as a state religion, something like a Pakistan or a Malaysia, or a democratic state that actually institutes Sharia law? Where's that dividing line that defines pure democracy?
Celeste, I think that we have to, again, allow the people to speak for themselves. Let me give you Pakistan's example. When Pakistan was founded, it was the largest Muslim nation in the world. It was founded by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who passionately believed in democracy. So whatever you may think of him personally, the ideal was democracy, human rights, women's rights, minority rights. That is the ideal. You cannot compromise on that. And remember, there's a debate, is Islam compatible with democracy? And I'm going back to the 1940s when that question was answered. The answer was yes, of course it is compatible. And it was given in the example of Pakistan in 1947, which was to be a democracy. Pakistan was to be a modern Muslim nation. So if the people of Egypt, and remember it's a very complex society, we hear about the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. Well, the people of Egypt have Copts living among them, 10 million of them, a very rich, a very sophisticated and ancient society. These are Christians. Egypt has Mediterranean influences. It is proud of its pharaonic, its old pre-Islamic history. It's proud of being Muslim. So it's a very complex society. The chances of Islam or one particular ideology dominating it are remote if people are allowed their voice.
Although what institutions need to be built in before we go to protect the rights of minorities? These have been challenges in the United States with African Americans. There are certainly challenges in Iran with the Baha'is. You've mentioned the Coptic Christians in Egypt. If the Muslim Brotherhood were to win a referendum and take a majority parliamentary role in politics in Egypt, what insurances for the minority rights would need to be enshrined in the Constitution?
John, this is one of the big questions of the 21st century, the protection of the minorities in any society, Muslim or not Muslim, and they really have to be guaranteed both, I would say, nationally, and I think the international community has a great duty to make sure that minorities are protected. Today, for example, Christians in the Muslim world are having a very rough time, even in Pakistan, where at one stage I was educated at a Christian school, a Catholic school, and then a Presbyterian college in Lahore. And today you hear stories of churches being attacked and Christians being attacked. In Egypt, Christians have been attacked and so on, and in Iraq. So we need to make sure that minorities everywhere, whether they're Muslims living in the West or Christians or other minorities in the Muslim world, that they are protected right in the Constitution, and the international community does not abandon them.
Well, a narrative for Egypt, a narrative for the entire world. Akbar Ahmed, chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University, Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom, author of Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. More on all this in our podcast, Wave of Change. Go to thetakeaway.org.